getting out of the bath and pulling clothes on over damp skin so that he didn't see me naked because I felt so harshly judged. Him glancing at me as I ate and knowing he found me disgusting. Suddenly, I couldn't wait to get away from him. "I need a piss," I said.
"You're doing it now. You're shutting down, Anna."
He followed me to the loo and accused me of fucking off to read or something, as if that was the worst thing you can do in the middle of a fight. I saw a chair in the hall and thought about picking it up and smashing it over his head, but I'm a lady. And anyway, I wouldn't give Estelle the satisfaction. Chapter 7. I locked the bathroom door behind me. I felt so hopeless, overwhelmed, I needed to make the noise in my head stop. I remembered the washing line rope in the cellar. I cursed my father and thought of the rope again. I vowed not to try anything while the girls were still in the house. It was already too much for them. I told myself, get through the next hour, that's all, and then you can think about it. But just for a moment, I needed to get out of here. I sat on the side of the bath and fumbled my earbuds in and pressed play. Could Leon Parker have killed his family and himself? Why would he? French police never asked these questions. But the Dana murders have the extreme and often unique signature of a family annihilation. There is a warmth and comfort in hearing about people in worse situations than your own. Pity is a hollow virtue. I like it. It's a form of self-aggrandizement, really, bigging yourself up by defining someone as below you. True crime podcasts are usually great for that, but sometimes you have to look really hard to find anyone down there. I had not murdered my family and killed myself. I hung on to that. Family annihilation is a peculiar crime. This is when a man, and it is almost always a man, murders his immediate family and then kills himself. The term annihilation is apt because what these events always have in common is the thoroughness of the murders. It is literally overkill, stabbing and then burning, shooting then drowning. The annihilator is in a state of high emotion and overcommits the murders. Often they kill everyone and then burn the family home down around the dead. To me, the Dana murders have that passionate, overwhelming signature of annihilation. They do not feel like the action of a disgruntled employee with no motive other than a tenuous link to radical politics, as the French police came to believe. Family annihilations can be divided into four types. The first is the disappointed family member. They are often hyper-competitive people whose identity is drawn solely from their achievements. They feel let down by their family's performance. A wife gets fat. A kid drops out of university or fails in a competitive sport. And because the family members have not fulfilled the role assigned to them by the annihilator, they are murdered as a punishment. This doesn't seem like Leon. He was an adventurer. He celebrated chance-taking, not achievements. Neither of his kids was involved in sport, and there were no recent failures or dropping out of anything. We can rule that one out. The next motive is spite. This scenario is very often a parent who kills the children of an estranged partner, a controlling family member, usually reacting after a victim has made a bid for freedom. The killer communicates their fury through escalating threats to the escapee leading up to the deaths. They issue ultimatums and believe that, having not met the demands, the person they want to hurt is responsible for the deaths. Again, none of this applies to Leon. He had two kids with two different women. He was not especially controlling, was on fairly good terms with both of them, and had recently married someone else. The third type of family annihilation is the paranoiac, where the killer is deluded and thinks that they are saving the family from a fate worse than death. The delusions are usually religious or psychotic in nature. Everyone agrees that Leon was in his right mind during this voyage. He was not deluded or religious. He had no especially strange ideas or sense of the world coming to an end. There are no reports of him ever having a psychotic episode. Most likely to be relevant here is the annihilation where the person has suffered a perceived loss of social status. For example, if they are bankrupt or expelled from their community for some social contravention. Here, the killer sees his family as part of his own social identity, and when he loses status, I'm using gendered language advisedly here, with no means of restoring it, he kills them and then himself. He values nothing else about himself but his status, and failure is experienced as a personal annihilation. The family are his chattels. They are nothing more significant than his limbs or his car. If he ceases to exist, there is no point in them continuing to do so. I was sitting on the edge of the bath, thinking that the last one did sound a bit like Leon. Being successful meant an awful lot to him, more than it would to most people. He liked skibo and fast cars and rich, beautiful women, even if they were obnoxious. Yet just 6 months before the sinking, Leon had married into one of the richest families in the world. Was he even capable of a family annihilation? Usually, perpetrators will have a history of mental illness or suicide attempts, of controlling behaviour with previous partners, or records of domestic violence. There was little in his past life that would support this. Leon had no history of suicide attempts. Well, I wasn't sure about that. I had the impression that he had at least contemplated it. Leon wasn't controlling, but did have one allegation of domestic violence against him. In his late 30s, he married Julia, Violetta's mother. Julia was an Italian supermodel, very famous in her time. Towards the end of their marriage, she gave a bizarre and rambling interview to an Italian magazine. She showed the interviewer bruises on her back and arms and claimed that Leon had beaten her. They divorced shortly afterwards. Leon never spoke about these allegations or his relationship with Julia. None of his subsequent partners made domestic violence claims against him. Julia later recovered from an addiction and wrote a tell-all, cash-in autobiography full of anatomical details about the famous men she had slept with. But she did not repeat the domestic violence allegations against Leon. She said Leon was the love of her life, and her cocaine addiction drove him away. Maybe he didn't hit her, or maybe she hit him and he defended himself. If you've lived with a drug addict, you can probably fill in the spaces in that story. I liked the way Trina Keeney told that. No drama, no personal share, just a coded call to those who knew that chaos. Poor Leon. I tried to remember how he had spoken about his daughter back at Skibo, but that was years ago, and Hamish was banging on the bathroom door. I pressed pause and heard his muffled voice. Anna, please come out. I need to tell you something. I was straddling worlds, from a cocaine-addicted Italian supermodel's autobiography to a cold bathroom in Glasgow. Then I wasn't. I was just sitting on the side of the bath, wishing I was dead. Hamish was leaving me. He was taking my girls. My friend had betrayed me. There were no mysteries here, just banal miseries. Anna? Please! Chapter 8. I shoved my phone and earbuds into my pocket and went back out, hanging on to thoughts of Leon's glamorous life because what was outside the bathroom door was so tawdry and real. Hamish was waiting for me. He turned away and I saw something. Was it just a movement of his hand? He had such graceful fingers. Some detail that sparked the deep furnace of love I had for him, and suddenly I wasn't angry. I loved him. I loved our little girls and our family. I knew it wasn't working, but I loved him. I loved our counsellor and our fights. I loved my girls and early mornings and quiet Sundays. I knew it was over, but I wasn't ready. I was drowning in loss. I covered my face and sobbed.
Please, Hamish, don't leave me, please. I'm sorry for how I am. I love you.
Hamish turned back and he was crying too. He put his arms around me and I sobbed into his chest and I kept saying over and over,
be kind to me.
Where did that come from? I don't know, but we both knew it was over. I was desolate. I begged him not to take the girls.
I can't stand to be away from them. A week is too long. I'll die. Stay, please. I'll leave the house, but stay, 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 stay.
He mumbled,
Anna, listen, I have to say something.
But then Estelle shouted from downstairs that the taxi was outside, and Hamish pulled away. And then we were all downstairs, and I was scattering the brick of resettlement cash all over the hall. Hamish's suitcase was all smashed up, and I had cut my leg and blood was running down my shin. Estelle was furious because I scooped up some of the blood and flicked it on her new dress. I was completely baffled by Estelle. Estelle was feisty and funny and intolerant. She once laughed so hard at someone farting in our yoga class that she fell over and broke her wrist. She was no fool. Had Hamish told her I was abusive? Was I abusive? But she knew that he had done all of this before. I told her about it. I was 5 months pregnant with Jess when Hamish invited me to his house for the first time. Come to the house at 8 a.m, he said. We'll be grown up about it. We'll tell Helen together. I knew then that he was a coward. Estelle knew that I got to Hillhead Underground Station, and instead of getting off and walking up here and telling Hamish's wife that she was being usurped by a younger model, I stayed on the train. I turned my phone off and went all the way around the circuit. Then I got off in town and jumped a train to Manchester. I stayed with a friend for a while. When I came back, Helen was gone. Helen wrote to me for a number of years. Unfriendly, let's say. I made myself read them. They were nasty, but I didn't tell Hamish about them. He might have cut her allowance. She wasn't working, and the letters had the sour, tangy odour of vodka about them. Estelle knew all of this, and she still came to the door as ordered. Following orders isn't for everyone. It's not for me. I watched them drive off in the airport cab. I was on the top step outside the front door, weeping with fury and impotence, when I saw our bitchy neighbour, Precha, coming back from walking her fat dog, Stanley. I couldn't deal with her. I was watching the cab leave with everything I loved in it. I wanted to run after it, barking like a dog, rescue the girls from their nice holiday, save Estelle from her new relationship, drag Hamish back to our mutual misery. Precha sauntered up slowly, hypnotised by her phone as usual. She's 50 to 60-ish and has never liked me. She calls me the au pair behind my back. She took in the drama through her tight, Botoxed face. We all had to pretend she hadn't had a metric fuckton of bad surgery. Be nice to them, Hamish always said. He basically runs German banking. He's incredibly rich.
Hello, darling, she said.
Just when you think something can't get any worse, someone who dislikes you comes to watch. I'm making this sound eventful. I'm making it ridiculous and action-packed. It wasn't like that. It was just humiliating and sad. Standing on the steps in spiteful rain, Watched by an unkind neighbour, the cab pulled away with my life in it, and I felt something snap in my chest. I wanted to sink to my knees and howl, rent my clothing, cover my hair in dust and curse God. But this is Glasgow, and I'm Anna MacDonald, so I just turned and went inside and hid. That was a mistake. I very nearly didn't get out of there alive. Chapter 9. I was on the floor in the hall. Mood very low. Paralysed with shock. I think I was there for a long while, hours anyway, but it was hard to gauge time. It was sliding around like a puppy on a greasy floor. I had settled on hanging myself in the bedroom, but was worried about who would find me. I saw the girls coming home from Portugal, rushing upstairs and finding my body 1 week old, bloated and rotting. I was disgusted by my weakness. I couldn't save them from what my father had passed on to me, but maybe I could save them from finding me. The attic. The girls couldn't get up there without a ladder. The smell would alert Hamish, and he'd come up and find me. The washing line rope was in the cellar, curled on a shelf, coiled and waiting for me. In a minute. I couldn't get up. I was there for an hour or two. At one point, I found my phone in my pocket. I had to do something. I couldn't speak to anyone. I couldn't have coped with listening to music. A stray minor key might have finished me off. I'm not on social media, for obvious reasons. All I do on the phone is listen to books and podcasts. Podcasts. I didn't know if I could face listening to that podcast. True crime only works if it's about people you don't know, scenarios you're not in. But I didn't know what else to do. I opened the phone and found myself on the Death and the Dana website. That was when I spotted the video file at the bottom of the homepage. It was 7 minutes long, not much of a commitment. Dive A241-7. It was hanging alone and didn't seem to relate to any of the episodes. I tapped play. The screen blacked out. The narrator, Trina, delivered a trigger warning, basically, don't watch this. Don't watch if you're too young or old or nervous or squeamish. Does anyone ever think those warnings are addressed to them? I didn't, and nothing could make me feel worse. Angry green sea filled the frame. It was silent, filmed underwater. A diver was alone in the depths, working his descent hand over hand down a drop line, filming from a GoCam on his chest. A beam of light swept back and forth from his head torch, crisscrossing the rope. Deep waves buffeted him. His muscled arms were tense, slick as sealskin in his wetsuit. The camera struggled to focus in the murk, fixing on specks of flotsam just before they were blown out of frame. An ugly industrial yellow font came up over the swirling green, narrated by O. Taskison, diving instructor, then faded away.
"He feels his way down the drop line," said Taskison. "His hands do not leave the rope."
His voice was flat and colourless, his accent mildly Germanic. He sounded bored, describing the scene with the muted emotions of a man who has seen a lot of life.
"Visibility is poor. The sea is violent. Many dangers. This is the life of a professional diver. Very hard, not a leisure sport. You will have many bruises from a descent like this."
A rope attached to the main line snaked away to a metal cylinder in the foggy green distance.
"The decompression tank is attached so that he can find it when he comes back up. He will not come back up."
I thought I had misheard. Taskison's voice was so dreary that it was quite hard to listen to. I watched as the diver descended further,
passing a bushel of oxygen tanks attached to the rope. "A dangerous moment in a heavy sea," droned Taskison. "Spare tanks might swing around and knock him out. We can look at his oxygen and pressure readings here. They are good. At this point, he is well saturated with oxygen and is thinking clearly. He is in charge."
Nothing but hands feeling down the rope for minutes. It became quite tedious to watch, but visibility gradually improved. Every so often, Taskison commented on the pressure of the diver's oxygen readings. Down and down the diver went, buffeted around the drop line by deep water waves.
"Now we can see the Dana for the first time."
The GoCam pointed down. In the grainy distance, like a dream remembered, the massive yacht was sitting on the seabed, banked precariously against a sheer rock cliff, upright but tilted. The mainmast had snapped and lay across the deck. He moved closer. There was a hole in the hull, small and round, the wood rotting outward so that the splinters looked like soft, rotting teeth falling out of an open mouth. It was sickening.
"There is a hole in the hull, caused by something inside. Now we have the answer to the question of what has caused the sinking. Something has exploded in the engine room and caused this breach. The ship would sink very quickly from this. Discovering this is the purpose of this dive."
The diver lowered himself, moving slowly, pointing the camera on his chest at the damaged hull to get good crisp film of it. Then he carried on moving down the line.
"This is his first mistake. He has secured the site and identified the cause of the sinking. According to the dive plan, he is supposed to return now to the decompression chamber."
The diver moved on down, letting go of the rope once his fingers reached the buckled handrail on the deck. He moved along the ship towards the back.
"He is making his way without a line. He is alone. He should not do this. He is in danger. His oxygen level is good, but now begins the countdown to his tank change. He has 2 minutes and 55 seconds of oxygen left."
The diver pulled himself along the rail around the deck.
"He is alone. I would not do this. This is a bad choice. A dangerous choice."
Even in a monotone, Taskison's exasperation was clear. The diver got round to the back of the ship and turned to face two small doors like a kitchen cupboard.
"He should not go in."
The diver tried to pull the doors open, but they were jammed.
"The wood has swollen. Also, differential pressure is holding these doors closed. Inside and outside are different, like the vacuum in a jar of pickles. This tells us that the cabin has been sealed since it was on the surface. No one has been in. No one has come out."
The diver lifted a foot to the surround and pulled hard. The doors opened and all around him water was sucked into the cabin. A rotting white ribbon on the handrail flapped in, then out. As stale water rushed out of the cabin carrying a cloud of papery grey flecks. The diver stood still until the water cleared, the grey washed away on an updraft.
2 minutes. This is another mistake. Performing acts of physical exertion while low on oxygen puts him in danger. It is this series of bad decisions that kills this man.
Kills the diver? I straightened at that. I didn't want to watch someone die. My finger hovered over the pause. Maybe it was a joke, but I knew it wasn't. I lied to myself because I wanted to see what happened. I ignored the second warning. I watched on. Chapter 10. The diver took hold of both sides of the door frame and pulled himself down into a narrow corridor filled with the dirty water. Papery fragments covered the lens. When it cleared, I could see that it wasn't paper. It was rotting varnish from the wooden walls and had settled in a thin silt on the floor. Every step the diver took sent a gritty grey squall curling slowly up to his knees. He stood still. The darkness inside was profound. Abruptly, the world jolted sideways. The diver's hand shot out to the wall, steadying himself as the Dana listed left. She shifted on the seabed, dropping half a foot.
"This is a danger sign. This means the internal pressure has been strong enough to play a factor in stabilizing the wreck. He has altered that. He knows this. His heart rate is up. The whole cabin could collapse in on him. Why is he in there? This is crazy. He should leave."
But he didn't. The beam of his head torch stroked the peeling walls. Ragged grey fragments of varnish floated slowly up from the floor, hovering in front of him, a chorus of tiny ghosts gathering to watch. Feeling his way with both hands, he made his way deeper into the ship down the narrow corridor. He seemed to know exactly where he was going. He came to the biggest door at the very end, turned the handle, heaved. It was stuck.
"He is too far in. He has 55 seconds. He should turn back. His calculations do not allow for physical exertions. His oxygen is running down."
Again, the diver used a foot against the wall and pulled with all of his strength. It wouldn't open. He tried again.
45 seconds. He should be leaving right now. He thinks the diamond necklace is in there. He is making bad decisions."
One last hard yank, and the door opened violently, knocking the diver off his feet. It took a moment for the camera lens to focus. It was a wood-paneled dining room. The grey muck was an inch thick on the floor. Three people were at the table, slumped in their chairs.
"They have been in there for a month."
They had been there for 4 weeks. In the salt water and the dark, the colour sucked from the meat of them. The soft tissue on their eyes and noses and fingers had rotted away to sockets and bone. Fresh track marks through the grey silt showed that the chairs had moved when the ship shifted, but it looked as if the corpses had pushed their seats back to get up and greet the new arrival.
"The ship has moved. Their thighs have been pinned under the table, but now they have been moved. These bodies are untethered."
Leon was in shadow, facing the door. I saw his silver hair hanging over what was left of his face. He was looking down at the table, head at an alarming, acute angle to his neck. He was in shadow because the diver's torch was on the girl in a rotting striped dress in front of him. I could hardly look at her. The image, what had happened to her face, that was hard to see. There was another body there, the t-shirt boy, slumped face down over the table.
30 seconds.
But the diver had frozen in the doorway. His torch beam and camera were locked on something in the shadows at the very back of the room. It was a boy, 7 or 8, same age as Jess, looking straight back at the diver. This face was not decayed. It was wholly intact, and his skin was piercing white. He was crouching in the dark, hiding in the far corner, glaring out with angry black eyes. Suddenly, a long strip of white light flashed from his mouth. This all happened in a few startling seconds, while water rushed in from the corridor and filled the chest of Leon's shirt. His head began to rise, everything in the room began to lift.
"It is the change in cabin pressure that makes this happen."
The bodies rose from the table, standing up, coming apart, heads tumbling from necks, arms dislocating and rising at the same time. The diver panicked. The camera lurched up to the ceiling, smearing trails of light. Desperate, he backed out. His gloved hands swiped through a swirl of murk as he got to the corridor, tumbling into black space. The camera snapped focus on peeling walls, on rotting ceiling, on his own frantic hands flailing and slapping at the walls. The hands slowed, their actions becoming soft and vague. Then they stopped. A final gloved hand floated across the frame, bidding the world adieu. The screen froze. He has run out of oxygen. He has died. I dropped the phone in shock and it skittered across the hall floor, rat-like on its thick rubber cover. I stared at it. The light from the screen shone upward in the dim hall like the dead diver's torch. I had forgotten all about Hamish and Estelle for a moment. I wasn't thinking about my girls. I wasn't mapping the journey from the cellar, rope in hand, to the attic. For those 7 minutes, I was thinking about silt, about the diver, about a boy hiding under the sea, about matter out of place. I pressed play on the second episode. Chapter 11. By the time Estelle's husband came to the door, I was half mad. The rest of the day was sore. I had ambitions at one point to get up and put the lights on, but somehow it never happened. I spent a long time sitting by the front door, not listening to the podcast. I sat between the ottoman and the cold marble pillar at first. Then I moved on to the ottoman. I was in shock, I think. I was there for a very long time, afraid to stand in case my feet took me to the cellar, tricking myself into living through the next moment by waiting for answers. Who was the boy? How did he get there? Who steered the ship? Where was Amila running to? Mostly, though, I wondered what Amila was running away from. Any story about women bolting catches my attention. Had Amila been attacked by a member of the crew? If so, did Leon know about it? Was he killed because he knew? Hours into the day, when my mind ran out of circles and it was starting to get dark outside, I pressed play on episode 2 and put the phone in the cup of my bra, speakers towards my face, forming a sound barrier between me and the door to the cellar. Episode 2, 7th of July. In this episode, we will look more closely at what actually happened that night. We will profile the people who died on board the Dana, Leon, Violetta, and Mark. To celebrate Violetta's coming of age, Leon had bought her an extravagant gift, an antique diamond necklace. It cost almost 750,000 euros and had a great provenance. Leon bought it at a charity auction in Malaga from Princess Alana of Sweden. But the necklace was ugly. An old-fashioned rope of daisy flowers made from diamonds clustered around bigger diamonds. Violetta made it clear that she didn't want the necklace. She emailed her father, saying that money or help with an apartment would be more useful. But Leon had a grand gesture style of parenting. It didn't really encompass financial support or help finding a flat. It was more suited to buying the most expensive item in a public auction in front of an international audience. Violetta texted her father. Please forgive the bad language here, but it's important to give a flavour of their relationship. V. I don't want jewellery. You shouldn't buy overpriced crap like that. Again, later on the same day. V. Because I have to insure it and store it and I can't fucking wear it anywhere. It'll cost me money. Gaudy jewellery was not Violetta's style. She liked plain designs. She was elegant and Leon couldn't have picked a more inappropriate gift. He didn't seem to know her very well. According to the phone company, Leon was out of range for a while, but when he docked in Balboa, he replied to both texts. L. Fine, V. If you don't want it, I'll give it to someone else. V. Fine. L. It's the nicest thing I've ever given you. V. It's the only thing. Again, long pause. L. Are you even fucking coming to San Martin? V. Of course, you crazy old bastard. Then a flurry of texts from Leon. L. You ungrateful little shit. L. I'm trying to give you a fucking necklace worth 750,000 euros retail. L. FFS. Violetta replied, V. Leon, never pay retail. L. Ha 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 ha. I love you. L. Come and see me. L. Sell the fucking thing. I don't care. And then, 3 hours later, L. Ha 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 ha. Still laughing at that. Those texts give you a flavour of their relationship. Violetta and Leon were informal with each other. She wasn't intimidated by her father or afraid to complain about his inconsistent parenting. Leon had not been a good father to Violetta. As a very small child, he left her in the care of an addict and walked away. When she was 9, Violetta was hospitalised for malnutrition. In recent years, Leon had been trying to compensate for that, and although she was still angry, they seemed to be getting on. Mark was the younger child. His mother, Daniela, worked in local government in Southampton. Daniela and Leon didn't marry. They met in a local pub and lived together in Leon's house in Sandbanks for nearly a decade. Sandbanks is a small spit of land on the south coast and is home to the most expensive property in the whole of England. After he died, Leon's house was sold for £21 million. Of the two children, Mark seems to have fared best in his relationship with his father. He got to 6 before Leon and Daniela split up, but saw his dad regularly. Leon attended school concerts and paid child support for Mark. No one said how Violetta felt about Mark, but he was clearly the favoured child. He was just 16 when he died. Daniela, for me, is the best argument against Leon committing a family annihilation, because an obsession with status is a major predictor of that style of murder. But Daniela plays fiddle in a folk band. She is a social worker. When Mark was a toddler, she worked part-time and studied for a master's. Their relationship was not about status. This was love ad hominem. They liked each other, were together for a long time, and when they split up, it wasn't acrimonious. Leon had recently married for the second time, to an heiress. He boasted that they spent longer signing the prenup on their wedding day than making vows, which doesn't seem like a man keen to make people think he has money and power. Leon picked San Martin as the rendezvous point because it was reachable from both of his kids' starting points. Violetta arrived on a private jet from Venice, was met by a car service in La Rochelle, and checked into San Martin's only 5-star hotel. She went shopping and spent over €1,000 on a Missoni dress. She went back to the hotel, had coffee in her suite of rooms, put her new dress on, and went to meet her younger brother. Mark Parker flew EasyJet from Southampton. He arrived a day early because the cut-price airline only flew every second day. He stayed in an Airbnb. In the listings, it looks like a camp bed and a shed. While Violetta was booked into the hotel for 2 nights, Mark was planning to sleep on board the Dana once his dad arrived, presumably to save money, and had his luggage with him, a boogie board bag. He had probably spent the day at the beach. These kids came from different backgrounds and very different income levels. That puzzles me. Leon was rich. Why was Mark staying in a shed while Violetta had a private plane? Julia might have remarried or made a fortune.
She's hard to track. Also, expenditure doesn't always speak to income. Daniela may just have been careful, whereas Julia was flamboyant. Perhaps Mark was being taught to travel on a budget. That's just speculation. Let's go back to what is provable, what we know about the movements on board that night. The kids walked down to meet Leon. He got off the ship and they went for a walk and a drink. The trio got back to the boat at around 7 p.m. The crew left, the Parkers gathered on deck and had a drink. Leon presented Violetta with the necklace she didn't want and made her put it on for a photo. Mark Instagrammed it and texted it to his mum. It was to be the last time anyone ever heard from any of them. Then the deck was empty. We can assume they had gone downstairs to the dining room because this is where they were found. Whether they were in there when the Dana motored from the harbour or elsewhere on the ship, we may never know. It was Leon who insisted the family would be alone on the Dana. Is it possible that Leon asked Amila to leave the boat? She has not spoken about him. Did he plan to kill the kids? Or was there a more benign reason for him ensuring they were alone? The crew thought it was because of the necklace. Violetta was travelling alone, going home the next day, and the diamond necklace was a high-priced item for a young girl to carry home. The crew weren't supposed to know about the necklace. Crew aren't supposed to know a lot of things, but they see it all. The bodies were found in the dining room with the door shut. From forensic video analysis of the remains on the table, the mussels garnishing the soup were still all in complete shells, not yet shucked apart. This means they hadn't been eaten, which means the Parkers were yet to begin their soup when the yacht went down. Were they already dead when the ship left the dock? Were they drugged? Leon wanted to show off the dining room, but it was a hot night. The natural thing would be to leave the door open for the breeze, especially if they were eating hot soup. But the door to the dining room was firmly shut. Why would they shut the door on an empty boat? What if Leon poisoned the kids before they started eating? Both kids die, Leon doesn't. With his dead children in the dining room, Leon casts off in such a state of high emotion that he forgets the navigation lights and the radio, and then returns to the dining room, shutting the door and sealing himself in with the two kids he has murdered, knowing they will sink when the explosion goes off in the engine room. This seems unlikely. In family annihilation, the killer usually covers or hides the bodies. They are not product killers, that is, people who murder so that they have a body to play with. They are not process killers who kill because they enjoy the act of murder. They are outcome killers. They kill so that people are dead. They are repulsed by the sight of dead bodies. They cover them with sheets, cover their faces, turn away from the bodies. This bothers me. The door being shut makes sense if the killer is outside the room and does not want to see the bodies, which raises the possibility of a fourth person on board, but there is scant evidence of that. The Dana was being watched by all the rooftop diners, and someone would have spotted an extra person on deck. No one that night saw anyone other than the two kids and the dad. These are all questions the police didn't seem to ask. Leon was barely glanced at by the investigation. Was it his new, rich wife, Gretchen Tiegler, who ensured that was the case?
Do you like to cook at home but find it hard to make the time? At Fast and Fresh, our service provides...
I stopped it there. I rewound. I heard the name again. Gretchen Tiegler. I rewound, I replayed, and I heard it again. Gretchen fucking Tiegler. I had vacillated about whether or not it was my Leon Parker, but I didn't doubt this was my Gretchen. Leon married Gretchen Tiegler. I could not believe he'd done that.
with no good reason, I felt personally betrayed. But now I knew what had happened to the Dana investigation. Gretchen Tiegler had done it again. She chose a lie that suited her and used all of her power and money to make it the official version. I hadn't thought about Gretchen for years. When I stumbled across news stories that tangentially referred to her, I always turned away. I'd done a deal with myself. I could let the past go because I had my girls, Hamish, my new life. Only now I didn't have those things. I looked up at the hall and hardly knew how I came to be here all these years later. I stood up, my knees stiff, pins and needles in my feet, and found myself turning almost against my will to face the cellar door. That was when I heard someone outside the front door. For just a moment, I thought I had conjured Gretchen Tiegler. Chapter 12.
Hello?
It was a male voice, muffled by the heavy door.
Is that you, Anna? I can hear a radio.
By this stage, I found it hard to even speak. I felt I was going blind. What's the point? I kept thinking over and over, what's the point of this? It's often the case when I'm down that everything dark that has happened comes back and swamps me. That thin voice outside was a pinprick of light. When I was small, I believed stars were pinholes and their light was the brightness of heaven shining through. This is what his voice felt like. A glimpse of an unreachable dimension of light beyond my catastrophe and Leon's death.
Anna? It's Estelle's husband, Finn. Could you open the door? It's rather cold out here.
Finn Cohen opened the letterbox. He looked in at me. I turned my head and caught his eye. He must have been kneeling down.
Anna, you don't look too good. Do you want to open the door?
I couldn't speak. His fingertips withdrew. The dry metal spring shrieked as the letterbox guillotine shut. The sharp echo rattled around the hall, up the stairs, humming off the stone floor, until I didn't know if I was hearing or remembering the sound. For a terrible moment, I thought that Finn had gone. If he left me here, I knew where my feet would take me. But he didn't leave. He opened the letterbox again and looked at me. He wasn't asking for anything. He wasn't giving anything either. He was just there. Gretchen Tiegler, again. Married to Leon. How could it happen again? How often had she done this? Looking at those eyes peering in through the letterbox, I saw a thousand other pairs of eyes, all the human detritus left in Gretchen's wake. And behind them, all the gatekeepers who helped her, the lawyers who drew up the non-disclosures, the journalists who didn't ask questions, the cops who took hints. I took the phone out of my bra and pressed pause. I looked back and Finn was still there, still looking at me.
Please don't leave!
He blinked.
I won't leave.
I'm coming out!
There's no need to shout.
Okay.
The letterbox screamed shut. I swung my body away from the cellar door and staggered upstairs on stiff legs.
Chapter 13. Pants, passport, cash. I changed out of my blood-stiff pyjamas into a shirt and trousers, grabbed an expensive leather coat I had been saving for the right weather, and took the keys to Hamish's car. Hamish thinks I can't drive, that I'm too afraid to learn. It's one of my many random fears. Of course I can drive. I just couldn't use my license because it's under the name of someone who is presumed dead, possibly murdered. But that's another story. I kept my eyes down,
walked back downstairs in the dark and scooped up the resettlement money scattered around the hall, shoving it into my pockets. I had a sudden strong urge to swing around and go down to the cellar, and I hurried away from it, almost running by the time I got to the front door. I threw it open, startling not just Finn, but also Pretcher. It was an odd scene. They were standing together on the top step. Finn Cohen was tall, blonde, and far, far too thin. His nose was long, his skin creamy. His beard was neat and pointed, but his blonde hair was thick and messy. He was dressed in a tailored green tweed suit jacket, jeans with turn-ups over brown brogues, and a tight grey shirt on his very slim frame. The top button was done up, but he wore no tie. He looked like a dapper, starving Viking. His look was stiff and formal. His shirt could have been cut out of cardboard. He was always groomed to the nth degree, which annoyed me. Pretcher was clutching her phone to her chest as her forgotten dog, Fat Stanley, lumbered up the stairs behind her. She was simpering up at Finn. I had never seen her do that. She was smiling and doing a strange little dip with her knee, as if she was trying to make herself smaller.
Oh, hi, darling.
She tried to smile wider, but the top half of her face was frozen. She may have been trying to express empathy or sarcasm. Who the fuck knows? Finn and Pretcher looked past me into the hall.
Oh, she exclaimed, her eyes widening at the scene. My gosh!
Good God, whispered Finn. I looked back. Breakfast plates were smashed on the floor. A bloody handprint was smeared on the wall. The contents of Hamish's yellow suitcase lay scattered, the toiletries stamped on. Flecks of light from the street were twinkled randomly everywhere in the dark. Sugar. I shut the door behind me and locked it. I took a deep down breath. Pretcher was the first to snap back to the script.
Oh, Anna, I didn't know you knew the Finn Cohen.
I didn't want Pretcher thrilling at the sight of Cohen or weaseling details about this morning out of me to pass around to the neighbours in little hors d'oeuvre of spite-laden gossip. I sound as if I'm being unfair to Pretcher, who never really did anything worse than wear a gilet and dislike me for being scary. But wait for it, I'm not wrong on this. She very nearly killed me. I don't know him, I said, and showed him the car keys. I'll drive you home, come on. Finn Cohen followed me down the steps. It was rush hour. Beyond a row of bushes, the Great Western Road was in full gridlocked swing. Headlights flashed, indicators blinked and engines growled. It was noisy and distracting. That's why I didn't notice Pretcher's flash going off as she took the picture. Chapter 14. It was a nice car. I have to give Hamish that. His intellectual life might have ended at Cambridge, but he does have an eye for a nice car. The engine was quiet and smooth, the seats deep and comfortable. Finn was shivering in the bucket of the passenger seat. Not in his extremities, not a tremble, but from so deep down in his middle it looked like tiny convulsions. He was embarrassed about it and didn't want me to ask, so I didn't. I just turned the heating up and pulled out of the parking space. Great Western Terrace has a sharp drive down to the Great Western Road. It was jammed with cars and buses, and it was a long time since I had driven. I kangarooed violently down the steep slip road, straight into the stream of rush hour traffic, almost hitting a car side on. The driver was angry and gestured at me eloquently. I pretended I hadn't noticed, though he was only 5 feet away from me.
Where are we going?
Asked Finn, his voice faint.
Well, I'm going to Fort William. Where do you want me to drop you? Are you going home?
Finn didn't answer me, but there was a lot going on in the road. I hadn't driven for a really long time, so I didn't notice.
The lights changed and the driver had almost rammed gave me an ardent finger as he moved away. I gave an apologetic wave. A few cars further down, a man let me edge clumsily into the stream of traffic ahead of him. I could tell from his expression in the rearview mirror that he was shocked at my driving. He left quite a big space behind me. "Finn, where'd you want dropped off?"
"No," he muttered. "I'm just around."
I stalled and had to restart the car. A lot of drivers were watching me now, and it's an understatement to say that they were unimpressed. I didn't care. Up ahead, a bus edged into a yellow box, and a chorus of car horns sounded around the junction. I was elated at escaping from the hall. I had got away from the cellar. God alone knew where reminders of Gretchen Tiegler would have taken me if I hadn't. I was grateful to Finn for that, but I wondered why he had come to the door. Did he come to tell me something? We didn't know each other. He may have been my best friend's husband, but he'd always been cold towards me. Why did you come to the house? Did Hamish send you to check on me?
Send me? Hamish?
His voice was very faint.
They've run off together. Do you know that?
Yeah, I know. To Porto. They took my kids. For some reason, I had assumed Finn was in on it, that he was okay with, or even the cause of it. I thought he would be having affairs with other women and, you know, maybe you couldn't blame Estelle. I didn't think it would be the same for him as it was for me. But that's part of being down. Empathy loss. I can't imagine anything might be worse for anyone else. Not really. He sounded indignant.
I'm not friends with Hamish.
The bus moved and we got across the junction to the next set of lights. It felt like another tiny triumph. Why did you come to the house?
I don't know. I was a bit, you know.
Finn's voice was soft, his breath stuttering.
I thought of you and just, I wondered.
I glanced at the passenger seat. Tears were dripping from his beard as he stared straight ahead at the road. He looked glazed and grey and his jacket was buttoned up over his concave belly. Finn? He didn't answer. Finn! Nothing. I couldn't stop the car and put him out. Not in two lanes of heavy, bad-tempered traffic. He didn't seem capable of finding his way to the pavement. I wanted rid of him now, though. Now we were away from Precha and I had spoiled her fun. I wanted him out of the car and I never ever wanted to see him again. Because I didn't like Finn at all. It wasn't personal, though I did think his band were whimsical and a bit crap. I didn't like him because he had snubbed me the few times we had met, and I suppose because Estelle bad-mouthed him a lot. Also, he scared me. I hate famous men. I don't remember him becoming well-known. I didn't know Estelle at the time. It seemed to happen very quickly, while I was having babies and being a happy bit of furniture. His band were young, just in their late teens. They'd only played small gigs in the living rooms of fans who won competitions. Without releasing more than a couple of demos, they were suddenly everywhere. I can't remember how that happened. It was Finn Cohen people were interested in, really. He was tall, groomed, and very good-looking. He was vegan, anti-capitalist, all the buzzwords. Hailed as the leader of a new subculture, he was interviewed on every topic from summer colours to climate change. He was everywhere. Worldwide fame. Huge in South America and Asia. It took less than 2 years for capitalism to eat him. Cohen lost a lot of weight. The press followed him around, taking pictures, charting his decline. He became terrifyingly thin and wore very tight clothes. His face hollowed out. Suddenly he was forced into rehab for opiate addiction. So far, so on trend. The band were self-managed, which Estelle said was like trying to run a train company from a smartphone. A massive, unexpected tax bill came in. All of their stage equipment was stolen in Germany, and they had taken out the wrong insurance. Then came the famous interview. The drummer got wasted and gave an interview to a nasty vlogger. I haven't watched it, but apparently the vlogger prizes everyone's secrets out of the very drunk 20-year-old. Their bass player was sexually predating on their young fans. This was true. He later went to jail for it. The guitarist painted miniature dragon statues as a hobby and lived with his mum. Their frontman, Cohen, wasn't an addict. That was a lie. Finn was anorexic. Addiction was cool, but an eating disorder wasn't, apparently. The band imploded, gone as quickly as they arrived, a footnote in music history. But celebrity sticks in a small town, and Glasgow is small. Estelle was Portuguese. She married him at the height of his fame, big diamond ring, rush wedding in Vegas. This was before the weight loss began. She was there for the car crash and she stayed, but it was hard. They were broke. His eating ruled their lives. He was in and out of hospital. I still saw blurry pictures of him on the cover of the Schadenfreude magazines, speculating about his weight and mental health. I looked at him sitting in the passenger seat, his thighs hardly touching, so thin that the safety belt might as well have been done up over an empty chair. He looked as if he was dying. "Finn, have you eaten today?" He didn't answer. "Drunk water?" "Huh? Do you want me to drop you somewhere?" He didn't answer. Mothering is a comfort. Even through a smog of suicidal self-pity, I found the voice I used for the girls. "Okay, Finn, you want to come and meet my pal Adam? Have a wee road trip up and down to Fort William?" I think he nodded. It was hard to tell. "Yeah, we'll go on a drive and see some sights, shall we?" He didn't answer. I should have listened. "Come on, then." I was driving. My life was in pieces. I had someone to look after. My leg hurt. It was all good, except that one small part of my mind was still unoccupied. I remembered Hamish, and the old dark feelings began to rise again. I couldn't stand to be alone with those thoughts. When we stopped at the lights, I got out my phone and I pressed play. Chapter 15. Episode 3. The Haunting. In this episode, I'm going to give a brief biography of the Dana to explain where the ghost story came from. Seafarers are superstitious. They are always looking to divine the future by looking at signs and patterns in the past. It's understandable. The sea is dangerous and unpredictable. Superstitions give people a sense of control. From her very beginnings, the Dana had a reputation for bad luck. In researching this podcast, we began to wonder if this was true. None of us knows the history of any other private yachts, and maybe these are common events in the lives of extraordinary people. So we looked into it, and compared to other yachts of the same age and size, the Dana had belonged to an unusually high number of people who met terrible ends. Was she cursed? Or was she simply a luxury yacht that was often the subject of a disputed title, and therefore bought by people likely to take other risks? The Dana was commissioned in 1929 by Harold J. Webb of New York City. Webb had learned to sail as a boy off the coast of Mayo in Ireland. He arrived in New York a penniless 14-year-old, threw in with Oney Moody, made a fortune from Prohibition, and set about gathering the totems of wealth. He bought a mansion, got a good Catholic wife from an old Boston family, bought cars and horses and suits, and he commissioned a yacht. The Dana was considered a masterpiece of her time. She had two generators, central heating, and electric refrigeration. But Webb didn't live to take possession of her. He lost his fortune over the course of 3 days of tumbling stocks in the Wall Street crash. On day 4, he rented the presidential suite at the Biltmore Hotel.
There he sat down at the desk, three arched windows at his back, wrote a short note, and then shot himself in the temple. But his hand slipped. He was using an antique 32 Derringer, a small pistol with a kidney-shaped handle. He lived on for another 8 months with no jaw, mute and bedridden, in excruciating pain, nursed by his estranged wife. There is a taped interview with Dana Webb, done in the 1950s,